Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the podcast, Reinventing Global Health. And it is titled Global Health from an African Perspective. My guest today is Dr. Joaquin Capalanga, who is a physician, scientist, and educator who received his medical education from Yale University, the State University of New York, Queen's University, and the University of Guelph. He is currently professor of pediatrics at the Schulich School of Medicine and Dentistry and the Southwestern Ontario Academic Health Network Knowledge Translation Group in Canada. His scholarship and research pursuits are in the epigenetic of neurodevelopmental disorders and exploration of shared endophenotype in neurobehavioral disorders. Is a member of multiple international scientific and professional organizations, and he has published extensively. He is the founder of the Society for Advancements of Science in Africa, SASA, and this is how we met in 2019 when Joe invited me and asked me to be the chair of the SASA annual International Scientific Conference in Toronto. So, Joe, to situate you better in relation to today's topic, please tell us what are your ties to Africa, starting from the beginning.
So, I was born in Uganda quite a few years ago, and I lived in Africa for a total of about 17, 18 years. And in East Africa for about 18 years, and then I moved to South Africa. I was there for about 4 years, and then I moved to Canada. And I've since then been between Canada and the US, spending about 8 years in the US training. And then I returned to Canada. So I've been in Canada, in North America for over 30 years. I did go to a medical school in Tanzania. And in Tanzania at that time when I went to medical school was the center of community medicine, public health, and health-related issues. Their medical education there was geared to making health facilities and health services available to the communities in all regions of the country. So theirs was not a hospital-focused healthcare delivery system, but a community-focused healthcare delivery system. And that gave me a good idea of how health should be organized, how health should be made available to communities at the grassroots level. And I then went to South Africa after that. I worked there for 3 years. In Botswana, actually, at the Gaborone Hospital, Princess Marina Hospital, which is now a center of intense research. A lot of North American universities and European universities are doing research, mostly on HIV and other diseases that are found in Africa at a higher prevalence rate than in other parts of the world. So there is the Baylor College Institute, there is Harvard, and other major North American universities have got programs at the Princess Marina Hospital and the University of Botswana. So now I'm in Canada doing research, teaching students, and providing healthcare. And I have also extended my activities into promoting science in Africa through the Society for the Advancement of Science in Africa, which was founded over 10 years ago. And the founders actually included, I was really not the founder, but I just brought the idea to the table, and they were at the same time, there were key people who really participated in forming the Society for the Advancement of Science in Africa. I don't think without Alain, it will have taken off. So people like Alain Faymat, Professor Alain Faymat was key, really key. He was one of the pillars in founding the Society for the Advancement of Africa. And
he was the first guest on this podcast. So briefly, can you tell us the focus, the African focus, main focus, regarding healthcare?
So the focus of the Society for the Advancement of Science in Africa is to make science relevant to promoting health, including research in health issues, medical research, and in improving healthcare at a community level. That is the one of the three pillars of the Society for the Advancement of Science in Africa, promoting health, advancing science to promote health.
Okay.
Specifically, that's what it is, one of these objectives.
Well, thank you very much for this introduction, Joe, because I think it's highly, cannot be more relevant to the topic today. And you have a broad and deep involvement in African healthcare and science.
Yeah.
So let me ask you my first question, and I think they are tied. What are the main problems with global health in healthcare in Africa, more specifically regarding manpower and infrastructure? I think they're tied. And if you could give us, based on your experience and beyond, a couple of significant success and also failure story that, and explain the reason why they succeeded or failed.
Okay, before I answer the question directly, I think it is relevant to define what global health is. Now, the understanding of healthcare, global health is defined as the understanding of healthcare at an international and interdisciplinary level. It includes the study, research, and practice of medicine at an international and interdisciplinary level. Global health is the health of the population in the worldwide context. It has been defined briefly as the area of study, research, and practice that places a priority on improving health and achieving equity of populations worldwide. Now, in the context of Africa, there are certain global health initiative players or stakeholders that are involved in global health. And this include individual African governments, the second organizations that are involved include intergovernmental agencies such as the WHO, the Africa Union, the European Union, and then also foreign governments directly often are also involved in global health. Foreign governments such as the US, through its various organs and institutions and government levels, such as Congress, the Senate, State Department, they have a say in promoting global health in Africa. The UK government and the EU, as I mentioned earlier, and China also do participate in global health, in promoting global health in Africa. In addition, there are development partners or government agencies which act at an arm's length from government itself. Such organizations include the USAID of the US, the National Institutes of Health, and other European organizations such as the Danish Development International Agency and the Swedish International Development Agency, SIDA. Global health is also promoted by academia, or academia at least get involved in promoting global health on the African continent. And this usually is on the level of research and specific health programs. Such universities as the University of Western Ontario, through its Africa Institute, participate in promoting global health in Africa. The Dalhousie School of Public Health of the University of Toronto, and other universities such as Harvard, the University of Basel in Switzerland, through its Global Health Africa program, the Brookings Institute through its Brookings Africa Growth Initiative. And then there is the inter-university. There are inter-university organizations such as the Consortium for Universities for Global Health, Consortium of Universities for Global Health. They also do something in global health. And then there are non-government organizations which are funded by the public or by grants from government. And this includes, for example, AMREF through its Women in Global Health program. And there is the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation through its the Africa Health Initiative program. There is Bill and Belinda Gates Foundation through its malaria, TB, HIV, AIDS, and pandemics programs. There is also the Swiss National Foundation through its community health initiative in Africa. Some of these organizations have other specific projects, which may be disease-based. And then there is business. The most notable example is the International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers and Associations in partnership with certain universities such as the Chatham House and the Graduate School of the Graduate Institute through its African Global Health Leaders in, Fellowship. So the business organizations usually influence policies on either funding or developing health programs across the African continent. There is also the Africa Health Foundation in Nairobi. There is another organization, business organization known as the Global Health Strategies. So there are a number of players who are involved in promoting global health in Africa. And that's a good thing. That's a good thing that a lot of players are involved.
Okay, Joe, thank you very much. I think this overview is very useful. And before you answer my first question, this begs the following question. What are the problems that you have experienced and that you know with this multitude or this myriad of organization and actors in Africa in promoting healthcare and health, global health? For example, duplicates and redundancies, or competition between themselves, or competition between them and government initiatives. What have you seen?
So actually, the fact that there are so many players oftentimes leads to confounding factors, to primary problems. So I'll call the problems that result from these many players as secondary or confounding factors. There are primary problems related to particularly manpower and infrastructure for healthcare across Africa. These are the primary, the bad primary problems are the shortage of skilled healthcare workers, the distribution of skilled healthcare workers, and problems with access, and problems with employment capacity and retention. So these problems, these primary problems, are confounded by the multiplicity of involvement of multiple stakeholders. So one of the problems is that there is no harmonization of the projects. There is no harmonization of participation or partnership. Each organization tends to focus on its own programs, its own projects, its own funding mechanisms. And then the governance structures of all these organizations are also different, and that confounds the problem. And also funding channels and modalities are not the same, they're divergent in all these different of the different stakeholders. Now, the other issue is, although money does come in, government often fails to track the resources. The mechanism for tracking, resources made available the mechanism for doing that is not very effective.
So
now, sometimes international players often have their own agenda.
Yes.
They earmark projects and earmark their funding to specific projects, regardless of the priorities of the recipient countries.
Yes, this is exactly what I wanted to ask you. Is those organization and those program, I mean, the people who carry out the programs are accountable to their organization to achieve the results. How are they accountable to the government? And how is the government synchronizing or overseeing all these projects? I mean, do they give guidelines? I mean, how does that work?
That's actually the weak point. There is no direct government oversight over the organizations that provide this health service. The government has no say, actual effective say, in how these programs are run, how they are funded, and how the money is used. And the governments do not really have either the political will or the mechanisms for harmonizing all these different donors and different organizations providing, playing a part in providing global health services. The other thing is programs that are started by international global health initiators often lack any long-term sustainability mechanisms. Because sometimes a program is started, and once the money that has been allocated for that program has been used, or the program has reached the completion as defined by the international player, the program ends there. One example that I always give is the H3 Africa program. That's the Human Heredity and Health in Africa program. This program was funded by the Wellcome Trust in the UK and the National Institutes of Health in the US and the National Human Genome Research Institute also in the US. The money that was available or made available at the beginning of the project was $87 million. And the project now has run its course. The program has run its course. In fact, it ended last year. But there is no continuity. They worked with the African Society of Human Genetics, which now finds itself without any other major program or project to pursue. And most of the people who were in the African Society of Human Genetics have now moved on. Some have actually moved to the US. So you see, the people who had experience in implementing certain global health problems moved on. So that money technically did nothing in Africa. It did not lead to a sustainable project or program. That's one major issue not having a mechanism in place for continuation of a program.
Mm-hmm. Also, as you mentioned, there is a shortage of human resources. So is there competition from all these different players to compete for the same people on the ground to carry out their programs? Because it's a limited amount, right?
So yeah, the global health initiative players often compete for the same skilled healthcare workers to participate in their programs. And so those skilled healthcare workers are really lost from the main health delivery system for the country, for the communities that they're meant to serve. So that's one drawback. And oftentimes, because of the interaction with the global health initiative players, the same workers will eventually get lost, because then they move to other parts of the world, as they have known people who can facilitate that. or they go to continue with the other projects that are other projects that the Global Health Initiative funders often have available, like the H3 Africa program. They moved the person who was doing most of the research at the University of Cape Town. They moved him to John Hopkins University to run a program there. So the program that was at the University of Cape Town wound down. So graduate students cannot be trained because that program essentially ended. So there is that draining of skilled manpower. After they have been trained on the African continent, they get drawn to other sectors. If they are not, if they don't go abroad, then they move to the private sector, or they go solo to do their own things. And those necessarily do not mean that there are activities that align with government priorities or with the community needs.
Mm-hmm. So yes, okay. So this actually, the some of those programs contribute to the brain drain, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and so there's, because there's such a disparity in all these programs, there is no prioritization, right? In they don't address necessarily the priorities of the countries or the communities. They address what is of interest to them.
That's very true. They come with an agenda or at least a program that they feel they should fulfill or they should carry out. But they can best carry it out in Africa. And after having done that, after having received some results, it contributes to their academic advancement in their home countries. Or they can make the data available to businesses that need the data, say, for example, for developing medication, for developing tests, for developing equipment. One discovery was about the use of a particular drug that was tested in California, and they attempted to test it in South Africa. But because of the research done by Ambrose, the guy's name is called Ambrose Wacom, they found that there is genetic disparity of the population that was tested in California and the population tested in South Africa. And so they made that information available, and the company was able to design a different test kit and medication for that, for the South African population.
So that leads me to a question about waste. What exactly about waste? And of course, the subsidiary of this would be a corruption and accountability. So what is the accountability for failures and for waste in terms politically and also in the judicial system? Are the people responsible and held accountable?
So most governments in Africa, in most for most African countries, the politics and the judicial system are almost not different. So government influences the judicial system, which is not, in most cases, not independent in a number of countries. And so implementing accountability becomes a problem, because nobody is going to prosecute wrongdoing when they know that the political repercussions can be quite dire. So even though regulations or rules are put in place to monitor certain activities or to monitor fund distribution and fund allocation, oftentimes when that happens, when funds are misused, it's just hard to prosecute. I think one case was, I think we had somebody who introduced, I don't know whether I should mention it, but one of the keynote speakers, not a keynote speaker, but somebody who opened actually the 2020 SASA virtual conference, was eventually found to have misused money that was allocated for the pandemic. And the story goes that the money was used to build malls. Although there was some outcry in the press, local press, nothing was done to that person, because that person was also a presidential advisor. So she was unreachable legally, politically, or by the public, totally unreachable. So that's gone. And you can see the buildings there, the buildings that have been erected, the mall, which was erected using money that was meant for fighting the pandemic.
I think you also have another example with SASA, with a conference at SASA in Africa, without mentioning the country. And
yes.
After answering this question, I will also ask the other side of the coin, which is example of big successes and why they were successful. Because I don't want to, you know, paint the picture.
So one positive thing that has happened, again, I'll come to H3 Africa. They did actually jumpstart genetics on the African continent to such a level that researchers doing genetics in Africa have really made groundbreaking research in a lot of areas of genetics, particularly population genetics and the genetics of sickle cell, to the extent that it attracted more funds. And this time it is more positive because a large institute for sickle cell was created in at the University of Cape Town. The building is quite impressive. There are specialists from across Africa now who work there, and which is a good thing because patients with sickle cell disease can be seen from at that institute, at that health facility, when they're from other African countries. They can go there and have service provided there. They can have diagnostic service provided. They can have counseling provided there. So that's a positive thing that the Human Heredity and Health in Africa program did. It did attract something positive and something that would be long-lasting. And it has also contributed to various centers of groundbreaking research in different African continents, in different African countries. Like now, there are research institutions working on health issues related to genetics, working in different African countries, and they collaborate closely. They meet every year in different parts of Africa. And so that's also a positive thing. Before, I think the African Society, we founded the African Society of Human Genetics about 20 years ago. I was one of the founders. Before that, there was no organized medical genetics on the African continent. There is research going on. The other thing that is still lacking is clinical genetic services are still not yet integrated. There is a lot of research going on, but clinical genetic services have not been developed properly, except in South Africa and maybe in North Africa, countries like Egypt and Algeria, but not in sub-Saharan Africa. So there are positive things. Heightened research in genetics is one positive thing. Establishment of the Sickle Cell Center at the University of Cape Town is another positive thing. And also some of the people who gained training through some of the programs that are run by the International Global Health Initiative partners, some of the people who got good training from outside. What some of these institutions, some of these organizations do is that they often improve the skills of their workers and send them out. And not all of them remain outside. They do come back and start either private clinics, start hospitals, or even training institutions, which contribute to increasing the number of skilled healthcare workers. And it also helped with the distribution, because in larger centers, there's a lot of competition, say, for example, for health facilities. And so a lot of people have moved to more remote towns or centers. And so that's a positive thing.
What about the people like yourself, for example, who have an impact in Africa, and other people who got the training in Europe or in the US or in Canada and go back to Africa?
So the latest development is what we call brain circulation, which means that individuals who have come from Africa and have trained highly in North America or in Europe can still retain their jobs in their adopted countries, but can go and contribute by going to Africa for, say, 1 month, up to 3 months, do either teaching or participate in research with the colleagues who are in those African institutions. There is a program run by one of the American foundations, I think it's the Carnegie Foundation, which has got an international university in Kenya. What they do is they encourage Africans who are resident in, say, North America or Europe to go and work in universities, in hospitals, in research institutes for a period of time. So that they're appointed, they have cross appointments with universities in Africa and universities in North America or Europe. So that is also a good thing that has been made possible because of some of the residual benefits that have accrued because of the involvement of international global health initiative players.
Okay, thank you, Joe. I would like to broach a little bit the topic of rural health, rural areas health. What is the trend? Do you see any improvement? Because this has always been a chronic problem.
So the rural areas are still underserved. The situation is better than many years ago, definitely better than 20 years ago, 50 years ago, but still a lot could be done for access and distribution. And that's because the facilities are underdeveloped. There are no diagnostic facilities. And then the pay is low. And even if someone wanted to relocate to a rural area, the local population is unable to pay private fees for services. So they rely on government-funded health services, which are not really well developed in the rural areas. One thing that could be done to promote the Alma Ata Declaration, which is primary health care, is health care provided to the community through individuals in the community by means they can afford through methods that they can accept. In other words, healthcare provided in the context of the local culture and practices and setup of the village. So that there was a move, and there was a program in Tanzania actually to train healthcare workers that are a link between the major health facilities and the rural health centers and community clinics their healthcare workers that were trained, and other African countries have also followed that trend of training these healthcare links between who are really a liaison between the major health facilities and the rural health facilities and rural clinics. So that is something that there was a high tempo in the development of that, but for some reason, there is a plateau that is not, there is not an increase in the number of those healthcare workers that act as a link between major health facilities and rural clinics. That could be promoted. That's an area that could be improved, because the rural areas, the communities, still lack adequate health services, particularly maternal and child health services.
What about the collaboration between different African countries? What is your experience?
Collaboration in terms of health, although the African Union tries to coordinate global health, particularly in areas of, say, pandemic control, immunizations, and infection control. And recently, there's also a program in non-communicable disease control and surveillance. Although the African Union is doing that, there is really little interaction or collaboration between African countries related to actual healthcare provision. There is no continent-wide organization that sets standards for healthcare for healthcare services across Africa.
Well, in terms of epidemic control, because I mean, the viruses do not respect borders. So, is there anything in terms of epidemic, or it all goes through WHO and CDC?
So now there is greater collaboration in controlling epidemics. Ebola seems to be quite resilient. There is a new outbreak now, I'm told, or at least the numbers are going up in Uganda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and to a lesser extent Rwanda. Recently, numbers have gone up, and so there has been a heightened level of collaboration between those countries, with the WHO, of course, facilitating the collaborations and the joint efforts in fighting the recent increase in the number of Ebola virus infections. So when there is a crisis, there is more collaboration, but at a baseline level, the collaboration is really little. It's really little.
What is the disproportion between funding and the priorities? There's a lot of money that goes into HIV/AIDS, but much less in other endemic diseases, for example.
Yeah, so the three big infectious diseases that are being funded disproportionately, malaria, tuberculosis, and especially HIV/AIDS, at the expense of other conditions that are quite endemic on the African countries, and countries such as schistosomiasis, river blindness, onchocerciasis, and various worm infestations. The other conditions that were previously neglected include non-communicable diseases such as hypertension, heart disease, diabetes. These are now also on the increase. The prevalence rate is going up, and so there is now an added impetus to also address those. But the funding and attention and research being devoted to those other conditions, the other infectious diseases and parasitic diseases, and also the non-communicable diseases, the funding are devoted to that is much, much less than that devoted to HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis.
Who decides? Is there any decision maker that decides the best return on investment in order to choose the priority?
So the discussions are held, say, during the Global Health Assembly and at a continent-wide level in Brazzaville through the AfroWHO offices, who then come up with the recommendations and highlights about prevailing prevalence of diseases and health conditions across Africa. And African countries are then led to pick up on those recommendations. And so it will really be the African government to demonstrate the political will and the financial commitment, the economic commitment to address those other issues that are so far not addressed. A lot of money from outside is directed toward HIV/AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis. Organizations such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation exclusively almost fund malaria and tuberculosis, and to some extent HIV/AIDS. And many other organizations follow that trend. The US government itself provides money only in those areas, HIV/AIDS particularly. The US government directly funds HIV/AIDS programs.
Is there any consequence, political consequence, if a program has failed?
There's actually no monitoring, and there is no flagging of either individuals, institutions, or organizations or universities that do not really deliver after they have been funded. There is no mechanism, universal mechanism, for holding organizations and institutions or individuals accountable, or even government agencies accountable, or even government itself accountable. The only thing that often happens, which is not often really related directly to the misuse of funds, it's often related to difference in political philosophies. That is when external governments will then either punish or sanction that particular government by withholding the funds that are meant for specific programs. But it's not usually not because of the programs not being run properly or funds being diverted to other uses, but it's just because of sometimes of there is political disagreement.
What is the influence of academia and scientific leaders on decision makers, particular minister of health, for example?
So that is a whole, there's a different level of problems. So academic institutions in Africa have difficulties in developing policy to government can and then implement, because academic institutions and academicians also have their own problems. And the four problems are that these academic institutions are poorly funded to the extent that oftentimes academics have to find another job. And because they have to spend time at another job, they often do not really devote a lot of time into doing quality research that can then be used to advise government so that government can implement it for carrying out specific health strategies. So that's one. The second problem is academic freedom. Institutions and academics are often not free to do what they want, because government funds these institutions, and oftentimes government appoints actually the top leadership of universities, such as the vice chancellor, and these are usually patronage positions. And the leaders so appointed will then go ahead and also appoint their own, they also exercise their own patronage and appoint their own friends, and not people who actually are qualified, who actually have the devotion, who have the determination, and who have who have the skills to be in those positions. And so that's that again, because if someone is appointed because he has not qualified, and he's not going to do the job to the level that it's supposed to be done, and to the quality, to a quality that is expected. So that's another problem. And then access to educational institutions. Again, there is some patronage there, and there is no access for certain groups, equal access, while other groups do have access, either because they have easy access to funding sources, or because they have individuals who speak for them in the institutions. The fourth, the fourth problem is that of actual funding of the student. So most academic institutions in Africa require that students pay fees, and the fees can be very high. Sometimes in terms of proportionality, they're even higher than the fees paid in certain European countries. So that acts as a drawback to individuals who may be very bright, very intelligent, but because they come from backgrounds that are lacking in resources, they are unable to go beyond a certain level of education, or when they go to, say, a university level, because they are unable to pay the fees, they then drop out, and so they are lost. So, and then brilliant students like that, who may have good ideas, do not bring those ideas to the table. And so those ideas are not made available to government and to society at large. So there are compounding problems there related to the contribution of academic institutions and academicians in advising government and in influencing the direction government will take in implementing, in certain strategies for promoting health in communities and in society at large.
Thank you, Joe. But as a follow-up on this, on what you just said, what would be your advice for people who want to get involved in global health in Africa, whether they be students, primary care physicians, researchers, teachers?
I think people should follow their heart, and they should, regardless of the challenges and obstacles, I think people should devote some part of their time, particularly healthcare providers, should devote part of their time to go and work in a rural setting. We did, when I was at the University of Dar es Salaam, we went to the rural communities for up to 3 months to just get a feel of what it is like working in a rural community and what the health problems are. So for those students who are from North American institutions, they should also go and have an exposure to community health issues in an African setting. And those often can have a positive impact to the upcoming professionals in what they do when they finally graduate. For example, we are now going, we are at the McMaster University, where I'm also a faculty. We have actually been making this, I've been holding discussions over the last 1 year, preparing students and residents to go to certain African countries to work in certain institutions and in certain communities so that they can gain global health. And they are taken through a training program that makes them go there so that they can appropriately interact with the local community and local healthcare workers so that they can go to communities and work there for some time and leave something behind. We urge them to leave something behind. We educate them about cultural norms and what can facilitate a pleasant experience. And also when they come back, they are meant to be debriefed about their experience and what they learned and what they intend to do and how that has impacted their perception of global health and also how that has influenced what they will do when they graduate as professionals. So people should get involved regardless where one is trained, whether it's in North America or in the bright corridors of African medical schools. They should all go and get some experience in rural communities. In the past, everybody was trained in the bright halls of medical schools, and without even going even to a community that is just a few kilometers away. But these days, not only in Africa, but also in North America, there is this movement for distributed medical education, whereby during the entire training period from medical student to fellowship, students and trainees are sent to have an experience in either a district hospital, a regional hospital, or a community setting to get some experience of anything from 1 month to 3 months. And in fact, I have students who go to a hospital that I provide service to in Owen Sound and also in PEI in Prince Edward Island. They come from different universities across Canada, and they go and get exposed to the experience in smaller communities. So that's another recommendation and positive development about global health.
So, but from your own experience and expertise, what are the priorities to change what is not working in global health in Africa, in the system?
So I think they should really expand distributed medical education so that they can have, they should have medical students be trained across each country, and even some can go and get an experience outside of their own countries in other communities across Africa. That's one thing at the training level. That should be what should happen at the training level. The other thing is there should be more collaboration between academic institutions that promote global health across Africa and between academic institutions in Africa and those outside of Africa, with a specific objective of having a positive outcome and impact on communities and improving access and equality of access in disadvantaged communities across Africa. That should be something that should be inculcated and should be elevated to a policy level so that even global health initiative players can follow those guidelines.
What do you have a good example of a program that was very successful and that can be scaled?
So there were a number of programs in Tanzania that were actually initiated by the Dutch foundation in the Netherlands. And those programs were subsequently actually adopted by the Fogarty Foundation, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. And that program has been scaled actually, and they did quite excellent work during the pandemic. So that's one example of a program that was scaled. It was a public health community medicine public health program that was to ensure that there are a sufficient number of healthcare workers at all levels, from what we call primary healthcare providers. But I mean, primary healthcare workers, that's not the same as the primary healthcare provider we know in North America. Primary healthcare workers are really at the grassroots level, and they're educated. They're people who come from within the community, and they understand their community very well, and they can deliver, say, health education in a context that's acceptable to the community, in a culturally sensitive way. So that is one case of a program that has been scaled up.
Mm-hmm. Now, would you have another example for sustainability, a program that has been sustained over the year?
Other programs that have been sustained are nutritional programs. There was a program on nutrition that was started by Oxfam, actually, way back, many years back. That was to an initiative to develop local diets, local treatment, and feeding treatments for conditions, malnutrition conditions such as kwashiorkor and marasmus. That was actually initiated at Makerere University many, many years, about over 50 years ago, by Oxfam. And that has been taken over by a number of other organizations. So there was very good collaboration, there was very good sustainability and congruence of objectives by different organizations. Although initially it was started by Oxfam, other global health initiative players expanded on that, they modified the initial strategies, they expanded the program. Initially the program was only around the communities around Makerere University, but that program has now been expanded to other parts of the country, and it's working well. So a nutrition program is working very well, and then a program to train healthcare workers in Tanzania is also working very well. And this has involved different global health initiative workers from overseas.
And my last question would be about an example of collaboration between Anglophone and Francophone country.
Yeah, that would be
basically West and East Africa.
So the best example will be the collaboration between Rwanda is considered to be really Francophone, but it's now real dual Francophone and Anglophone. Rwanda collaborates really well with some projects in Uganda. And the Democratic Republic of the Congo also have been collaborating well in the Ebola pandemic. So that's the Francophone Democratic Republic of the Congo and Anglophone Uganda. So those there's been a good collaboration in that respect.
Okay. Well, I think we reached the end of the session here. So I would like to thank you very much, Dr. Joaquin Capalanga, for this very informative discussion. And I think a lot can be drawn from what you just said. The next session will be on global health and chronic diseases, and it will be with Dr. Giulietta Gabbiola, who is a professor of medicine at Stanford University. Thank you very much, and see you next time.
Thank you, everybody.